Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 124, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And welcome to this week's podcast. Now, we do come out every single Friday, and we try and get everything into a concise 1 hour in this show, and we do pack in a lot into 60 minutes, I think, on this podcast.
It is crazy, and it kind of makes it like a little bite-size portion. You know, you've got your news section and then your interview. It works quite well, and I'm quite amazed with the amount of guests that we're getting from listener suggestions at the moment. So if you're on Discord, please suggest guests, because we've been running out of ideas. We've been doing this for how many episodes?
2.5 years now.
2.5 years. We're running out of people that we want on. And you guys have started to suggest some wonderful people like David Crane and just fabulous guests that we've had on. And we've got an amazing one for you today.
And I mean, just before we get into that, David Crane, you mentioned then we got to number two in the iTunes check chart last
week. Yeah.
So that's incredible. So if you are on Discord, if you're not familiar with that, that's essentially, it's like a cross between a chat client and a forum for gamers.
Yeah, you can leave messages, and we've got different sections. So come on our server and introduce yourself, but also please suggest like anything you want on the show. You know, it doesn't have to be a guest. It could be a live event, or it could be just us doing something totally crazy.
Or a news story or something. It's all appreciated, guys. So if you want to get involved in that, there is a link to our Discord page on our website, theretrohour.com. Now let's talk about the guests that we've got lined up this week. This is Mark TDK Knight.
Oh, Mark Knight's amazing. I first met him in Germany, actually, and he was playing violin, but with chip tunes and kind of playing alongside them. But he also worked for Mindscape as the audio specialist. He worked for Bullfrog Productions, EA sound team. He's a BAFTA award winner, and you know, he's done the soundtrack with Theme Park World and just loads of amazing, fantastic titles.
And he's working with Rob Hubbard at the moment as well, isn't he?
He's doing the Project Hubbard, yeah.
Which, you know, when we hear more from Mark in the interview coming up soon, he tells us how, you know, Rob is really one of the guys that is responsible for getting him into not only electronic music, but also getting him into making music for games and that kind of thing as well. So this is kind of a thank you to Rob, which I think is really cute that 30 years later, he's now kind of working with his hero, essentially.
Yeah, it kind of comes full circle, doesn't it?
Yeah, so Mark TDK Knight, really good chat, ranging pretty much from those early, well, even the VIC-20 era we talk about.
The demo scene as well.
Yeah, all the way up to like another PlayStation and modern day, his recent work with Codemasters. So all very interesting. Mark TDK Knight is our guest on the Retro Hour podcast, and he'll be on in around 15 minutes from now. Now, as if we weren't busy enough churning out this podcast every week, you're going to do another one, Ravi.
Yeah. So we've been getting a few messages and a lot of people asking, because I was doing this DJ set and I've put it online and I've been doing my DJ stuff, and they've been saying, can you do a DJ set on the Retro Hour? And I was thinking, I don't want to ruin the flow. You know, not everyone wants to have banging beats coming into that.
Well, I've heard your DJ sets, and for people that haven't heard Ravi's DJ sets, you use Commodore Amiga computers to do it on. And you know, there is some pretty, like, dark, dirty jungle and stuff in there.
Oh, yeah,
as well,
of course.
Not for delicate ears.
Not at all. So, I am launching a new podcast, and this is going to be called the 8-Bit Mix. So, if you go to the 8bitmix.com, we'll have information on the show, and it's going to be on the first Saturday of every month.
So, this weekend?
Yeah, this weekend, tomorrow, Saturday the 2nd. At 7 p.m, I will be streaming on Twitch, and hopefully loads of things won't break and fall down.
You've jinxed it now.
The cat won't interrupt, yeah. But I'm going to be streaming on Twitch, but I'm also going to be pumping it out to SoundCloud and iTunes and all the other stuff. So there'll be an audio archived version. I'm going to try and cover a different genre every time. I'm not sure with this week. I don't know if I'm going to go Acid House or 90s Cheese.
Just doing one podcast. Not busy enough, are you, Ravi? At least two.
Well, this one's, it's kind of like me practicing DJ, but I just film it and record it. So,
and it keeps you out of trouble on a Saturday night. You'd only end up in some sleazy bar.
Yeah, that's it.
If you want to get a link to that, we'll put that in this week's show notes at theretrohour.com. And just before we get into this week's news stories as well, we have to give a big shout to the people who make this show possible. Now, doing a weekly retro gaming podcast, you know, anyone will tell you who does podcasting, there are more costs involved than you might think. You know, even stuff like website hosting and the hosting of our audio service to pump shows out every week, the amount of space that it takes up as well, and the live events and stuff that we put on. It all adds up. And Ravi and I, obviously, we love doing this show. We don't mind paying for it out of our own pockets, but we do appreciate any donations that we get that do all 100% go back into the running of the podcast. And just for doing a little donation through our website via PayPal or at cryptocurrency, if you're into that, you will find your place in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Now, this week, we want to say a massive thank you to Charles Aswood.
Greg Girk,
Mike King,
and Matthew Cox,
who all made donations into the running of the show. You can do the same. You'll find that PayPal button. Literally put your email address and it'll take about 5 seconds at theretrohour.com, and then you'll get a shout in a future episode. Right then, before we get into our special guest, Mike TDK Knight, so many mini consoles. It seems like every week we're talking about what the N64 rumoured mini that's coming out soon.
They're going to run out, aren't they? It's just going to get up to like Xbox One mini.
But there is apparently going to be, well, this has been the rumour that's been doing the rounds. It's not been confirmed, but there has been talk about a PlayStation 1 mini. What do you think of this?
I think you can get a PlayStation for a tenner from the shop anyway, so what's the point? And to me, a PlayStation... It's probably because I'm old. A PlayStation seems modern. And that's just because it was that CD era and that new technology. Of course, it's not modern. It's like slow. What is that? CD drive? What's the kind of speed on that?
Not very quick, yeah. No. Like double speed or something. But I think one of the reasons that the PlayStation 1 maybe doesn't feel as retro as other systems that were around at the time, for example, like the Sega Saturn, to me, does feel very retro. But again, it's because you mentioned then that PS1 console that didn't come out till the year 2000, and that was on sale for probably till about 2005, 6, 7. You know?
Yeah, it was like they kind of... It was a really smart move, actually, wasn't it? They got a second life out of the whole thing because they re-released that smaller version. And, oh, those little screens were fantastic on them, weren't they?
I forgot about those little LCD screens that you could plug in.
Yeah, everyone used to hack them to bits. Yeah, use them on everything.
Well, the reason this rumour's come around is this is actually on Twitter. Now, I'll put a link in our show notes to an article on GamesRadar.com. Because we've had, obviously, all the Nintendo mini consoles coming out, that kind of, you know, Sega one as well, the At Games one that they're going to be officially backing now. Someone essentially went on Twitter and asked PlayStation boss John Cadera, what are you going to do about a PlayStation 1 mini then? Is there any chance of it? And he didn't say they are going to do it. He said there are no official plans. But he said, this is a quote here, it's been translated obviously, so it might be paraphrasing a little bit, but our company is always digging up past assets, and I think there are various ways to do it. There have been discussions happening in Sony of what kind of ways there are.
Well, I think there has been a mini revival of PlayStation kind of titles, like Crash Bandicoot HD and stuff coming
Wipe
out. Yeah, there's been an interest in there. You know, if they had a HD angle for it, but I don't know if playing the original ones in HD, maybe if... Ooh, this is interesting. Okay, so have you seen PSC2 emulator?
Is that the one that does the upscaling?
Upscaling, yeah. Imagine if they added in anti-aliasing.
Higher polygon count.
Yeah, because they can do that, because the PlayStation emulation's actually really nice. So, you know, unlike the N64 emulation, which is horrific.
Well, that's a pretty tricky console to emulate, the M64.
It was,
wasn't
it?
Last week we said, you know, if they do an N64, it probably makes quite a lot of sense because the emulators aren't great for it, but there are pretty decent PS1 emulators that you can get on most platforms, aren't there?
Yeah. But I think that those extra features are with the PS2 emulator. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's going to be interesting, though. It would be cute to see a mini PlayStation.
But then the PS1 kind of was, anyway. Can you get it much smaller unless it was like the size of a credit card?
It's going to be on your, like, keychain, isn't it?
Well, I imagine you couldn't put discs in if they make it any smaller because, you know, it's not going to fit them in. But some people...
Mints. That's what you're putting.
But some people have been saying, and I've read this all over Reddit, people saying that they couldn't do a mini PS1 because the games were on CD. So, you know, there are like 600 to 800 megabytes. It's going to take up too much storage space. But then, what, you know, the N64 mini we were talking about last week, the rumour and that's going to have maybe like 21 games on there.
How much is a 32 gigabyte mini adapter, SD card?
It's £6. Yeah. You know. And I'm sure Sony can buy them cheaper.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't think that's a concern at all. I think they don't have to put the whole library on there. They put about 20 games on like Nintendo have.
Ridge Racer, Tomb Raider, all those kind of games. And yeah, you've got a hit.
Or to make it even cheaper, you could have an SD card in there. And this is something else as well, because a lot of these classic PS1 titles are available on PSN. Mm. So if they essentially just make it Wi-Fi enabled, put your own SD card in there, a bit like the Nintendo Switch, and you can download all these titles off PSN, then that's got to be a no-brainer. And it'll get on all the licensing issues of getting it on the hardware as well.
Yeah, and it would be cool if you could play stuff in widescreen and stuff like that.
Yeah, if it does have some like enhancements on there, and it's kind of packaged nicely, which I imagine it would be. But I think it's cool. I mean, if they sell it for a price point where, again, it's under 100 quid, and it's a nice little novelty to have any Christmas stocking.
You know what? If this comes out, you know what I think is going to get absolutely everyone? Everyone will be going, where are the DualShocks? Where are the DualShocks? Yeah. And it's like, they came out on the PS1, but not on the PlayStation.
Yeah, the original PlayStation didn't have the analog buttons are first.
Yeah. So they'll be like, oh, where are the analog sticks?
I'm sure they put them on.
Yeah.
Well, most PlayStation 1 games did support it, didn't they?
No, there's quite a few that don't.
Yeah, I think after Tomb Raider 2, pretty much.
I've been playing quite a lot, and I've been playing with one of those PS1 tabs, and I've been putting the analog sticks on. No reaction, just totally kills it. Yeah, D-pad.
Well, there was a button in the middle you could press for analog as well, I remember, wasn't there?
That's it. You put that on and it just kills everything.
Yeah. But I think, you know, some people have been arguing that the nostalgia isn't there for the PlayStation, but I think that it defined a revolution.
I think that's just because we're old, Dan. Yeah. Like, the nostalgia is there, it's just we didn't have it.
Yeah, if you're like 18 years old or 20 years old, it probably was your first system. So I think there's a market for that. Again, you see all the proper gaming enthusiasts on Reddit and 4chan and stuff have all been saying, like, oh, you can emulate it on your PC and all that, though, but that's not the people who are buying these mini consoles.
No, it's not. It's the mum that walks by and goes, oh, remember when Harry got his first PlayStation? Yeah. Let's get him one there.
Exactly. Yeah. Or it's like, yeah, you know, maybe a wife will buy it for a husband for Christmas or something, like, you know, cause it's a bit of novelty, but they're not hardcore gamers who are buying these mini consoles, I don't think. Now, if you are a hardcore retro gamer, chances are your original PlayStation 1 has many titles, many discs that maybe you've got nicely presented in your man cave or your game room. The only problem is with those PlayStation 1 discs, they had a custom case that is not the sturdiest of case design.
No, I remember the sound of stepping on those cases. Yeah, oh, it was bad.
Or even when you get a game and, like, you know, the little spokes, the little CD teeth that hold it in.
The spokes are all broken, yeah. Or the end, you know, where the actual hinge is. Yeah. The end would always get knocked off and I'd have to, like, glue it back together, but you'd have this massive kind of scar coming through there.
And they were quite fat hinges on those as well, weren't they? But not as sturdy as they looked. And you can't just go out. I mean, the thing about it is, if you've got a lot of other retro CD-based consoles, a lot of them just use standard CD cases, so it's easy enough to get replacements. If you are missing some nice-looking cases for your PlayStation 1 collection, we have got a little Easter egg on our website, theretrohour.com. There are actually selling official empty game cases for the PlayStation 1 by Sony on Amazon at the moment.
And they've got the hologram, which they used to actually have, all of the kind of stuff. And, you know, I've gone out to car boot sales and I've bought old PlayStation cases just to get my collection looking nice. Yeah. And then I can't throw the game away that I've bought with the old cheap one. So now I've got to find a case for that. And it's just getting more things.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, you don't want to kind of sabotage an old game to get your collection.
Save another, yeah.
Exactly. So if you want to get some official empty game cases for your PS1 collection, these come in packs of 5. They're just over 20 quid, actually, which is not bad value considering how custom they are. And if you use our Amazon affiliate code on our website, you'll be helping out the show as well. So that's always a bonus.
Good for a pristine collector that wants to get, you know, the whole thing kind of lined up.
Yeah, we're the same. You found this today and I was like, okay, I've ordered the package.
So, yeah, yeah. You know. So you get some like Resident Evil collector or something. They're going to love that.
Exactly. I'm sure Joe will be on the case. So if you want to find that, I'll put that in this week's show notes, along with all our stories at theretrohour.com. Now, a guy that we have both got a lot of respect for, he did a lot for the personal computer industry. Come on, he's a legend, Steve Wozniak.
Oh, Steve Wozniak. I've asked him about 6 times to come on this show.
You'll get him one day,
right? One day, Woz.
You're a smooth talker. Well, maybe the reason that Woz hasn't been on the show yet is because he's quite a busy guy. Obviously, you know, kind of founding the personal computer industry via Apple, that was a pretty big thing,
yeah,
I imagine.
Building a computer from paper and all of this kind of stuff, yeah.
But also, did you know that Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple, was actually the world champion of Tetris?
Really?
Now, this is a pretty cool story. I mean, it has been quite well known, more in America, I think, you know, from readers of Nintendo Power magazine, that was actually held quite a lot of high scores back in the day, including his most famous one in Nintendo Power magazine. In 1990 and 1991, was actually submitted several high scores to this mag for the Game Boy version of Tetris. Now, he was featured in there 3 times. Once was a letter that included photographs in there as well that was printed in the reader's letter section. And he got a score of 507,110. And then he topped that, 546,000. This time, his name was listed as Evets Kainzo, which is Steve Wozniak spelled backwards.
Oh, nice.
So the story was that, you know, he'd submitted his score and, like, topped the chart that many times. They kind of banned him. They were like, you know, we can't keep putting you in there. So he reversed his name so he'd have a new entry in the scoreboard.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs worked for Atari doing Breakout, which is a very kind of similar game to Tetris. Well,
puzzle game, I guess.
Puzzly kind of game. So he must have had a lot of practice on those kind of machines. And it's amazing that he's homing his skill in still. still this day. Do you think it's on his original Game Boy?
Well, apparently he gives out Game Boys for gifts. I'm not sure whether he still does, but it's quite a well-known thing. If Woz likes you, buys you a Game Boy with Tetris, apparently. So apparently that was the case up until the mid-2000s, at least. But then people were kind of wondering, whatever happened to that score? Has it ever been topped? Now, the way this worked is Nintendo Power Magazine actually kind of changed their high score pages around the mid-90s. So as it turns out, he did actually hold the record in there when he had the 546,145 points. That was never bested in there. But then Twin Galaxies actually had his score on there as the world record until 2005, when someone finally knocked him off.
Dun, dun, dun. Who was it?
They didn't give the name in this article here. But then, this is pretty cool, Woz put something on his website saying that he'd already topped 702,000 and he was about to break the 750,000 mark barrier, which would put him about, I think it's third place in the World Championships today.
You know, once you've invented the kind of personal computer and stuff, you can sit and play Tetris, can't you, for years and just beat your score.
I guess you're never going to do better than that in your life, are you?
No, you're just like, oh, well, I'll sit and get a high score on Tetris, I'm done.
But, you know, there is now a kind of campaign that this website, NintendoLife.com, a kind of champion. It's like, you know, we want a King of Kong-style battle. Get Woz back out there playing Tetris.
Oh, yeah.
He needs to claim that world championship again, I think, doesn't he? So, yeah.
You never know. He could be sitting at home in bed now on a Game Boy.
Just waiting for that day. So yeah. Let's get a change.org thing started or something, Rav. Let's get some petition going. That'd be amazing, though, wouldn't it? Come on, Woz. Get that Game Boy dusted off again.
Oh, lovely. I'd love to talk to him about it.
Yeah, maybe one day.
One day.
We'll try. If anyone knows Woz, by the way, you know, or if you just want to tweet him, I'm sure if enough people tweet him, so get on the Retro Hour podcast, Woz.
Woz at woz.org.
Is that what it is? Email address? All right, okay. I was going to say Twitter, but no, yeah. Spam his email address. That's fine, yeah. Now, do you remember a game called Caveman Ninja that starred Joe and Mac back in the day?
I remember Joe and Mac, but I don't remember Caveman Ninja. And I only know Joe and Mac through Arjo, who kind of showed us Joe and Mac.
Well, this game, it came out in 1991. It was on the Amiga. It was on the Super Nintendo, I believe. Mega Drive, I remember my friend Martin had it on there. And it was kind of a platformer game, kind of a side-scrolling beat-em-up, really, where you had, obviously, these two caveman ninjas. They had kind of, like, axes and stuff to throw around too. Pretty fun game, but now they're actually going to be re-releasing this game. It looks like there have been not a lot of kind of visual upgrades. It's quite faithful to the original, but it's going to get a re-release on the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, Steam, and Nintendo Switch. And it's a bit of an obscure title to get a re-release. But
yeah, because I don't see it as massively popular. Maybe Chuck Rock or Son of Chuck, Chuck 2, or something like that could.
Well, there was a lot of games around that time, bizarrely, that did kind of were set in that kind of caveman era. I remember BC Kid as well. Do you remember that?
BC Kid, yeah. And they'd usually have a big club, wouldn't they, or something. Or there'd be strange dinosaurs. Yeah, it was a really weird period, wasn't it? Kind of caveman gaming on platformers.
Yeah, for about 2 years. There was a few of them. And it was around the time that the Flintstones movie came out as well.
Maybe, yeah, the live-action one.
Yeah, that might have had something to do with it. But I do remember it being a bit of a craze for a year or so in the early 90s. But, I mean, I kind of vaguely remembered this game. When I saw the news that it was getting re-released, I was like, oh my God, yeah, that's the game we used to play with my friend Martin. It's not a game I've probably played since about 1992, but I will get it on the Switch because I'm off on holiday in a couple of weeks, so that'll be good to play.
Well, talking about the Switch, have you seen a Modern Vintage Gamers video recently?
Yeah, he's doing some homebrew, isn't he?
Homebrew? He's ported Outrun to the Switch himself.
Yeah.
And he's also ported Postal. So he actually has a clip of us talking about Postal with Vince Stessi. And this is amazing. So we covered the firmware hack that was done the other day. Mm-hmm. Check out Modern Vintage Gamer's video because he totally covers it. But then he shows you how he's porting this engine. And then he starts to announce more and more. And it looks like this scene's really kicking off, this emulation scene, using that little jumper trick.
I haven't done it yet. I'm a bit nervous still. I heard, apparently, there was one guy that did get his console banned by Nintendo. But then, like someone said in Reddit, oh no, getting banned from Nintendo's online service. I thought, how often do I even play it online anyway?
Yeah. I'm actually tempted to get a Switch now. I wasn't before, but
don't
now.
Does your missus have one?
Yeah, but she won't let me do that.
Get one of the hairpins. Whoops.
Yeah, that's it. So he shows the two methods, actually, and one of them is using tinfoil.
Right.
On the side.
Is it really that simple?
Having that tape round. Or, yeah, it just is. It's just shorting these pins. And there's about four pins that you can short. And then you can put it into recovery mode and then you hook up your PC and it kind of flash it with this firmware, then you can put custom stuff. So what he was doing is he was creating programs in BASIC.
Right.
And then flashing BASIC programs that he'd made just then straight onto the Switch and then playing them straight away.
You know, I'm off on holiday in a couple of weeks and we're going to Spain. Samantha likes somebody and I get very bored. That's why I take my Switch and stuff like that. That could give me a whole new catalogue of games to play.
Oh, totally.
Shall I try it this weekend, let you know how I get on?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You break my Switch, I'm holding you responsible.
That's it, I didn't do it.
So if you want to find out more about that, we'll put the link to Modern Vintage Gamers video in the show notes. It's a great channel anyway, you should check him out.
Oh, fantastic. He's done several on the Switch now, so he's doing a full look at all the emulators available. So that one's really good.
So yeah, we'll put all those in our show notes at theretrohour.com. And that's the same place that you'll find everything else that we've talked about in this week's episode. If you do listen on iTunes, reviews were always appreciated. We haven't had any reviews for a couple of weeks in there, I don't think.
So no, we'd love some. But also, our guest today is going to be doing an event that's coming up soon, which is called...
Say it slowly, Ravi.
Let's get chip faced.
Chip. Yeah, just chip. Verify. Yeah, keep that family friendly non-explicit tag, please, actually.
Yeah, so that's at the Swan with Two Necks, which is a rather interesting sounding pub in Macclesfield on the 23rd of June.
Don't wear your Sunday best.
Yeah, and that's going to be TDK and Kojin as well. So this is going to be like amazing. You'll be able to see live chip violin in Macclesfield. Oh, we should go, Dan.
Yeah, have you got a link to that as well?
Yeah. Okay. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Cool. Yeah, there's a Facebook event, so we'll shove that in our Facebook page as well. But now let's get some stories from him, because he did so much, you know, back in the day. Like you said, Bullfrog, EA, Mindscape. He's a BAFTA award winner. Worked on titles like Theme Park World as well. So here he is. This week's special guest is Mark TDK Knight. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome this week's very special guest. I should say that this week's guest is a BAFTA award winner. Let's get that in there right at the start. Welcome to the show, Mark TDK Knight.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Great to have you joining us.
Thank you.
Now, this is a question that we always like to start with to get a bit of background. I mean, kind of going back to your earliest days, do you remember your first computer memory, where it all started for you?
I think my first ever computer memory was probably being introduced to a BBC Model B at my middle school, with the that turtle plotter thing that used to go around with pens that you could draw
logo.
So I think that was my first ever introduction, and then I think quite soon after that they started up a computer club with a number of VIC-20s, which I can't remember anything about it, but I guess I went. It must have been that memorable.
Well, you must have come from a musical family, because you were taught violin at an early age by your granddad.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my granddad was a professional concert violinist in Poland. He was Polish. And that's what he did before World War II. But he joined the Polish Air Force and came over to the UK and flew with the RAF as part of 306 and 309 squadrons, but still part of the Polish Air Force, and then stayed afterwards, because I guess by that point he'd met my grandmother. So in the 1960s, he went back over to Krakow and picked up his violin and his sheet music from a basement, which had luckily survived. So I guess I was around about 6 years old, and he started me off on the violin. He passed away only a couple of years later, but at least gave me a starting point, I suppose.
Well, I heard that you were quite into biking. How did that kind of lead to you getting your first Commodore 64? What was the link there?
I loved my bike, as most sort of, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds do, and I spent all of my time outside riding around, chasing cars, and I think that was the problem, was there was a particular hill in Brighton, quite a steep hill called Brabourne Avenue, I raced a police car down it, not thinking that me dad, also being a policeman, that they might kind of say something to him, and they said something along the lines of, look, if your lad keeps on riding like that, we're going to be scraping him off the street. And so I guess Mum and Dad had a very short conversation where they concluded the best thing for me was to get rid of my one and only be-all, end-all toy, whatever. So I was devastated, absolutely devastated, because for me there was nothing once the bike was taken away from me.
In a weird kind of way, then, the Commodore 64 was kind of like a punishment for like losing your bike.
Yes, indeed, because it would have been... My birthday is only 2 weeks after Christmas, so I was lucky enough that I tended to have combined Christmas and birthday presents. I think a friend of my mum's from her karate class was getting rid of a Commodore 64, and they bought that for me for my for a combined Christmas birthday present, and that's what really really got me hooked then, because I started to hear Sid.
Well, that's quite ironic, because today I guess parents often try and get the kids to go outside because they're in front of the screen all the time. But then it was a bit different, though. They tried to keep you in off your bike and on a computer.
How things have changed. Yeah. I'm in exactly the same boat with my Led. You know, he's 10 years old now, so around about the same time that my bike was taken away. He's gets very, very addicted to certain types of games on the iPad, so I'm quite controlling over it on his behalf, shall we say.
Well, you mentioned it was amazing the first time you heard the Sid chip. What was the kind of first thing that you listened to on it?
It would have been quite basic, because although, you know, I was into playing the violin and that side of music, so, you know, performance and that sort of thing, I didn't really listen to the radio, so I had no concept of commercial music. I didn't have a cassette player. My mum and dad had a record player, and my dad had a reel-to-reel thing, which he had, I think, Bohemian Rhapsody and Tubular Bells on it. But the 64 came along and suddenly started making these odd bleeps and bloops and noises. And for whatever reason, I fell in love with the sound. So back then, I mean, you're probably talking about quite basic tracks like Forbidden Forest and Super Huey. A little bit before Rob Hubbard and the likes of him and Galway and that started becoming the people to create soundtracks on that machine. I used to, you know, like I said, I didn't even have a cassette recorder. So I used to go around my nan's house, and she had a cassette recorder as part of this massive, great big hi-fi thing. And I could just about stretch the microphone from where her recorder was to her mono television. And I started recording Commodore 64 tunes onto cassette so that I could just play them at my nan's house whenever I wanted to. And obviously it grew and grew from there. You know, she had a cassette recorder, I needed a cassette recorder. And, you know, I guess I could have bought shares or in TDK, the amount of cassettes that I was buying to record all this Commodore 64 stuff.
But what kind of C64 setup did you eventually grow into then? Were you stuck with the data set, or were you one of these posh kids who had like a floppy disk drive? And...
Oh, no. I had a bread bin 64 with a cassette deck that would only load games if it was upside down. And I think I must have had an issue with one of the chips popping out of the motherboard or something, because quite often... The 64 had to be slammed against the coffee table a couple of times before it would start working properly.
I think that was often official warranty advice. If you called a Commodore because your machine was broken, they'd be like, you know, lift it 6 feet in the air, then drop it, and that would generally fix it half the time.
So what was...
They used to do that. I remember my nan saying with her television, she had a Sony TV, and back in those days, sort of like the late 70s, early 80s, part of Sony's testing of their TVs was to drop them from a certain height to make sure they still worked afterwards.
And it'd resocket the chips as well, wouldn't it, if they'd come loose?
Well, what was it like the first time you heard an Amiga? Like, the change must have been insane with all those samples.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, by that time I had got a cassette deck and I was buying more commercial music. So, obviously, commercial music had what we would call realistic instrumentation, and then the Amiga came along, and for me, I think the first thing I heard on the Amiga was was a Yellow remix of a Yellow track called Tied Up that was remixed by Dr. Awesome for a public domain music disc. And, you know, suddenly I was hearing saxophone sounds and proper drum sounds coming out of this machine. And indeed, it was that track that made me get rid of the 64 and buy an Amiga instead.
It's not a lot of kids, you know, Ravi and I included, kind of got into Amiga music via games, but obviously then you discover the demo scene and disc mags and music discs and packs and all that kind of thing. How did you get access to all that and find out about it?
It starts off at, you know, at school, in your class, and then kind of spreads out to other people at the same school in different classes, and they then introduce you to people who might be at a different school in the same kind of area. And I think it just expands exponentially over time as you learn about, you know, BBSs or freaking telephone calls or whatever. You know, you just pick up things on the way that expands your horizons, I suppose. I mean, I started off kind of, I wanted to be in a demo group with a couple of mates in my class, and we had a name called the Cool Crackers Corporation, but we used all K's and decided that KKK wasn't a very good idea for a name of for a demo group. We never released anything anyway. But then I had a mate who was in a group called the Hacking Relation, and then that moved on to Crack UK and a bit of Flash Productions, and then Anthrox, and then Melon Designs. So it just keeps growing and growing and growing as you learn more about what's out there and available to you.
And it was kind of the ultimate accolade to be part of a group that had respect as well, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, it was difficult for me in a lot of ways that you know, I was kind of starting from scratch, learning how to compose, and so most of what I was doing, frankly, was pretty crappy. And once I'd found the niche for the chiptune side of things, and it became apparent that other people quite enjoyed it as well, then there was actually the demand was coming to me rather than me trying to find the demand, as it were.
Well, you really seem to focus in on chiptunes, and could you explain the difference between a small chiptune and a kind of big full demo tune?
Yeah, I mean, on the Amiga, the only real difference is the amount of memory that you're taking up. Yeah, I can't use limited channels or anything like that as a definition, because the Amiga had four channels, whether it was chip or full-size modules. So the main point was that you know, a full-size module would have a, you know, a recording of an instrument that may well last a second or even 2 seconds long, and sound like that instrument, whereas with the chiptune stuff, we were kind of making single cycle waveforms of a square wave or a sawtooth waveform and using that as the instrument. So keeping the size down, I think, you know, 6K was around about the smallest you could produce if you wanted a few instruments, because the size of each Pro Tracker pattern took up a certain amount of memory as well as the samples. But anything under sort of 30-40K, I'd say, was considered chiptune back in the Amiga days.
It's crazy the amount of space that you could kind of use to create a tune compared to nowadays. Like,
oh yeah,
I see these demo comps where they do, like, what is it, 40K competitions and stuff. It's insane.
Well, I mean, and now, like, on the PC, you can use kind of tracker software that just uses inbuilt synthesis. So the instruments then are taking up a matter of bytes. As long as your PC is powerful enough to generate to synthesize the sound in real time. So, I mean, now you can get sort of like 4K, 10K demos, which sound like proper full-blown synthesizers, because they're rendering everything in real time.
And then you've got the other 16 gigabytes on your PC doing nothing.
Most of that's probably just Windows.
Well, you moved on from the demo scene and got into working commercially in games. How did you get the job at Mindscape?
Yeah, well, I mean, so sort of like the background behind it was I finished school, I went to college, and apart from music, I flunked everything at college because I just didn't go. So I was spending all my spare time kind of writing chiptune, really. Mum would go to work, and I'd go to the park, wait until she'd gone to work, and then go back home and spend most of the day at home rather than at college. And then after college, it was like, okay, decisions. What do you want to do? Do you want to go to university? What do you want to do? And by that point, you know, obviously I've discovered synthesizers and MIDI and computers plugged into synthesizers and sequencers. So it's like, well, music technology was the obvious thing. And back then there were only two courses available. There was one at Kingston called the Tonmeister, where you needed A grades at A level in maths, music and physics. Don't ask me why maths and physics, but that's what they wanted. And then there was Salford University who didn't. So I applied for Salford and I went up there and I did an audition with a violin with a pickup on it and some floor effects that I borrowed from a shop called Future Music. And the feedback that I got after my auditions was that it was felt that a classically trained musician couldn't deal with music technology. They did offer me a BTEC, an HND, which I kind of, told them where to go. I'd already got a Saturday job at Sainsbury's. So, okay, I'll apply for management training. During that time, I was still sending floppy disks off to all the developers whose addresses I could find in the back of, you know, Amiga Format or the One magazine or whatever. And literally the day that I was filling out my management training application form, I got a call from Mindscape asking if I'd be up for quoting to do Wing Commander on the Amiga, which obviously, yes, please. And I got the gig, I think, from what I understand, because I undercut Richard Joseph by 50%. So I think they took a punt on somebody who was completely new and gave me the gig. And from that, they offered me an in-house job. So luckily, they were only sort of 10, 15 miles away from Brighton. So it made a lot of sense to go ahead with that. And that was the break into the industry.
Well, Wing Commander was a really kind of classical instrumental beat, and it was made on PC MIDI. Was this easier for you to convert, or was it just really hard because it was a new thing?
I suppose it was easy in that the music was written for me, and indeed I had the MIDI files. Martin Galway actually was working at Origin at the time, so he was my contact, and so he sent me the PC MIDI files, which luckily the Atari reads PC files. I had an Atari as well as an Amiga by that point. So it was simply a case of using your noodles to try and figure out which of the 24 channels you were going to use for your four channels on the Amiga. Obviously using samples of chords and whatever to try and fill it out a bit. So I can't really say it was hard or easy. For me, it was doing something in Tracker, which I enjoyed doing. It just happened to be somebody else's music. I, in some ways, being orchestral might have made it a little bit easier for me, because it was using traditional instrumentation. So, you know, I'd find the equivalent samples on whatever synthesizer I had at the time. And that was it. So there wasn't a lot of creativity involved. It was just trying to shovel it all into four channels. And I think aside from the title track, I had 110 kilobytes for sample RAM. So we decided that we'd keep that resident in memory and just load the song data in, because it was an interactive soundtrack as well, so it needed to load as quickly as possible. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say relatively simple. I mean, I listen back now and I cringe at the samples, but that's what happens when you improve over time on how the processes that you use to make something happen.
Well, did they have like a kind of approval? So, you know, Origin basically asked you to convert one of their games. Would they then approve the track afterwards? Or
I didn't have any of that.
Just have free reign?
I guess there was an approval system in place for the game itself. All I did, just to be completely sure, was I had the Fat Man's email address, who wrote the original or most of the original PC music.
And George Sanger.
George Sanger, yeah. So I sent him recordings of the Amiga mods on a cassette for him to have a listen to. I don't think I have the letter anymore, but he sent back a very congratulatory, positive reply. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't really get a lot of feedback. I mean, things were a lot different then in games development generally to what they are now. So yeah, if I was doing it now, then I'd expect about 20 different people to be trying to stick their fingers in the pie to add their own criticism so that they can get a credit on the manual for some kind of music production or something. But back then, I don't think anybody really cared.
Yeah, because you were doing a lot of conversions for Mindscape. So were the companies different at all in the way that they approached it, or was it just generally no one caring?
Nobody. I mean, I had, you're right, quite a few. I mean, there was Battletoads. Yeah. Or Battletoads, and for that I had a cassette of the NES music. Alfred Chicken was David Whittaker. Then there was a load of Maxis stuff, which frankly, you'd be hard really to call it music. It was very, very ambient, very, very random. So I just tried to accurately recreate the randomness. So yeah, I mean, in original stuff, there wasn't a lot with Mindscape. There was Captive 2, and there was Out to Lunch. Well, was there anything else?
Well, you did remind me of Alfred Chicken then. I'd forgotten about that game. I got that for Christmas one year, I remember. I'm playing that all Christmas Day.
we put him in for the Christchurch by-election.
Oh, really?
And I don't think he came last. I think he got about 18 votes or something. Alfred Chicken went into the Christchurch by-election, however many years ago that was.
Well, you mentioned Liberation, which Captive 2, which was a really ahead of its time game. Had a cool soundtrack. What was it like when you first saw the title?
I couldn't make head nor tail of it. I mean, don't forget, we get to see things when they're not finished. And, you know, I mean, Captive, it's a very niche-looking game, shall we say. I'd say a traditional gamer would take a look at it and think, well, what's this mess? I didn't get a lot of time to play the game. I more had design documents as to what the game was going to be when it was finished. So it was trying to identify the style from that. I mean, luckily, the Herman Serrano, I think it was Herman, did the intro video. So that was what I was given first of all, and that kind of set the style then for the rest of the game. And you know, once you have a theme, then you'd be prudent to try and reuse that as much as possible to flesh out a soundtrack. So yeah, that's pretty much what I did. I took the video. At that time, I didn't have much music equipment at work because I was using my own stuff until somebody spilled coffee over it. So I took it all back home. So I literally wrote down on a piece of paper what happened in the video with timings, with a stopwatch, and then went home, wrote it over, I think it was a day and a half. And then took it back to work on a DAT tape, and then everything else kind of flowed from that.
Well, what was the atmosphere like working at Mindscape? Was it a fun place to work?
It was superb. I mean, I was 19 when I started. I wasn't the youngest, actually. There was another guy there, Paul, who was younger than me. But the age range in the department, I guess, stemmed from sort of 18 to about 26, 30 years old. And there were, I mean, off the top of my head, between 10 and 20 of us. So it was very much a family. We were all young. We were all pretty naive. I would expect that most of us, it was our first job. I mean, my boss, Richard Leinfelner, that wasn't his first job because he was one of the main guys behind Palace Software. He was the programmer behind Barbarian and Barbarian 2. And I think that's why Richard Joseph did a lot of work for Mindscape, was because Richard used to work together a lot. But it was a lot of fun. Yeah, I look back on those days with a lot of smiles, especially, you know, you compare it to what the industry is like now, which is a lot of it's a corporate hellhole, to be frank, with everybody thinking about dollar signs, no regard for staff well-being or anything like that. So yeah, very, very different back in those days. Very, very enjoyable. miss it.
Well, how did it start to differ when you started doing titles for Nintendo, like Mario's Time Machine?
Oh, God, the edutainment. Well, again, they were third-party titles, so I'm presuming, I know nothing about it whatsoever, but I'm presuming that we purchased some kind of license to use the Mario name and the Mario ecosystem. And yes, I actually found those games quite difficult. I actually did two Mario edutainment titles, but one was never released. There was one called Mario's Mission Earth and another one called Mario's Time Machine. And the thing that made it difficult for me was I had what has to be the worst audio development system I have ever, ever, ever encountered in my life. And not only it being the worst, it had no documentation. So I didn't know what I was doing with it. You know, I was on the Amiga, I was used to sampling a sound into Tracker and playing it back, and there you go. I had no idea about the Super Nintendo's requirements of compressing the sound, what you had to do to a sound to make it compress properly and make it loop properly. So I used to beat my head against a brick wall just trying to get a sample to loop. And indeed, if you listen, there's quite a few of my old Super Nintendo stuff on YouTube. If you listen to the instruments, pretty much all of them have absolutely abysmal looping, because I simply couldn't get the instruments to loop. So I probably would have enjoyed mucking around with the Mario tunes a lot more had I not just been struggling with getting it to sound anywhere close to being professional. It just sounded horrendous. So it's to the point where I started having nightmares about being chased in the dark by Super Nintendos with three legs, where the power button and the reset button were eyes, and it had big triangular teeth at the front, and it was chasing me, trying to eat me. That is God's honest truth. I had dreams like that because of how nasty the SNES was to develop on.
Yeah, because you had to convert Out to Lunch as well, which had come from the Game Boy and the SNES as well. So that must have been another nightmare after the Mario games.
Yeah, well, Out to Lunch. I think we led Out to Lunch on SNES, and then we did an Amiga version as well. I think it's that way round. I'm not sure now. You might be right. It might have been Amiga first and then SNES, but for sure, the Amiga versions of all the tunes are much more well thought out. The only I did a different title tune for the Amiga version because I felt the SNES version, yeah, so it would have been SNES first. The SNES title tune was so basic, again, because I couldn't get instruments to work, and it was MIDI-based, so I'd write on the Atari, and then the Atari plugged into the development box with MIDI, I think. I can't remember. And it was just horrible, whereas the Amiga, you know, obviously a new Tracker, I could at least sample and make a sound loop on the Amiga, and it just kind of worked a lot better for me, even though it only had four channels compared to, was it eight on the SNES?
Yeah, I think it was eight, yeah.
Yeah, it's going back too far now.
So the CD32 came out. Was there any quality control from Commodore?
A lot of what we did at Mindscape was literally the Amiga version plonked onto a disc. I did do specific CD32 versions of Alfred Chicken. Wing Commander wasn't. Wing Commander just had the modules. Captive obviously had a CD audio soundtrack to it. But in terms of quality control, I wouldn't like to say either way, because I simply wasn't involved. And, I mean, don't forget, I mean, I'm sort of 20 years old at that point, so I'm extremely naive to what goes on in game development. You know, I literally came into work, sat in my room, wrote some stuff, went home, and that was it. I didn't have a lot else to do with developmental processes, I suppose, back in those days, because I didn't really know about them.
Well, later you got to work with EA and Bullfrog Productions. What was it like working with such massive names at the time?
Well, Bullfrog was my dream job. Out of all of the developers out there, Bullfrog was where I wanted to be. And I'd had a few interviews at a few different places. I had an interview at Probe with Fergus. But I'm not really the sort of person to leave a job after 2 years, But by that point, I'd been made redundant from Mindscape, and I'd done Duke Nukem in that time as well, and then the Bullfrog gig came up. It's an interesting one because EA basically took Dark Omen. They bought Dark Omen off Mindscape in a nearly finished but not complete version. They then took on the development team, which was basically all the guys that I'd been working with, but I'd already been made redundant because I finished the music early. So they all went to EA Bullfrog, and I was kind of like, oh, okay, well, there we go, never mind. And then suddenly I got a call saying, would I like to interview for them? Which obviously I wanted to. I wanted to work for Bullfrog. I loved the games they were doing, but I also absolutely loved the sound, the work that Russell Shaw did. He's got a very, very creative way of fusing sound design with music, and I thought I could learn a lot from them. So I was ecstatic when I was given the job. What they didn't tell me in my interview was that I was actually replacing Russ, because he was moving on to Lionhead. So I had a week's handover with Russ, and then he'd gone. But there we go. I suppose in a way that gave me the opportunity to put a bit of Mark Knight into the soundtracks that I worked on, I suppose. But yeah, I was ecstatic to work there. I think once you started working there and you realised quite easily that the Bullfrog in 1997 wasn't the Bullfrog of 1992, 1994. You know, Peter had left a lot of, but not all of, the core staff had gone. And of course, EA were going through their pretty standard set of how shall we ruin this company? You know, they've done it time and time again. Westwood, Maxis, Bullfrog, etc. So by the time I joined Bullfrog, you know, I guess a lot of the core Bullfrog employees would say that Bullfrog wasn't Bullfrog by that point. But I still call myself a Bullfrogger anyway. But yeah, for sure, you know, we had Populous, Dungeon Keeper 2, Theme Park World, everything else that was going on. Some of it was really, really cool because we still had people like Glenn Corpez, who was one of the core members of Bullfrog. He was still there. But EA just didn't understand a lot of the things that those people were coming up with from a design point of view, to the point where the last Bullfrog game that we did together as Bullfrog was a Quake 3 conversion on PlayStation. That's where EA were putting, you know, that's what the EA were turning us into. And then it was licenses, you know, Bullfrog. It was essentially Bullfrog people working on either Harry Potter or Formula One. But then, of course, the brand name had gone, and it was back to Electronic Arts by then.
Well, you mentioned as well that you'd done Duke Nukem as well, Total Meltdown for the PlayStation 1. Yep. Is that a meme or something? I was looking online and there's thousands of comments saying like strobe lights or something like that on one of your tracks. It seems to really have kind of hit people, that dance beat that you created for it.
the bar music. Yeah, I mean, that particular track is just an arrangement from the PC version. I just danced it up even more. And it's in countless number of memes now. Just these two, is it Family Guy characters or something dancing to it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've just seen so many comments just saying strobe lights yeah, everywhere.
It's quite bizarre because, you know, I had no idea all this stuff was going on. I just wish that I had the video with that in, because it would be pushing over a million hits by now for sure. That's got to be worth 10p.
Well, you were the lead of Populous, the beginning on Bullfrog, kind of doing the soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
How much did you get inspiration from the original on that one?
Well, I mean, it's an ethnic-based game, and I guess, for some reason, most of the games that I work on, I just managed to nail down an idea that seems to work. I had a manager at that time who was very musically orientated, so I would imagine that he would have had something to say about the style. Yeah, it was kind of like, okay, it's kind of Neanderthals, there's magic, What, you know, what sort of instrumentation do you use to kind of get that point across? So from that point of view, it's pretty simple. You know, you switch on the Roland JV and you load up the world expansion card and start playing around with the presets until you find things that you like. Before you're told that you're not allowed to use presets anymore. but whilst a lot of the melody lines and that are quite ethnic sounding, I use a lot of flutes and pan pipes and, you know, wind instruments and that. A lot of the backing in Populous at the beginning is actually quite synthetic, which is more me, you know, whatever I try and work on, no matter what the game is. Whilst I'll do my best to be faithful to whatever the game style is, I like to be faithful to myself as well, so that hopefully people will pick out that it's me that's written the soundtrack. I don't want to be a generic sounding, you know, oh, right, well, I'll copy this person and I'll copy this person. I do try and find a way of being me, but I also look at introducing styles that I may not have worked on before, because then that gives me a learning experience. Populous would have been the first soundtrack that I've done, apart from, you know, the odd arrangements of Max's stuff, where it had no percussive element. I mean, eventually there was a percussive element when you were when you were fighting, but the music wasn't written with that in mind. The idea for having the percussion came a little bit later. Which is why then we overlaid the percussion on top of the background music in real time, rather than having it mixed in, because a lot of the music had already been recorded and was in game by the time we decided to put the percussion in. But yeah, I mean, it's you obviously you've got a visual style, so that's very, very important. And then Back then, when it was all, you know, hardware synthesizers, it's a case of going through what have you got. I had a couple of samplers as well, although we didn't have a lot in terms of sample libraries, and playing around to see just to see what comes out. There was a lot of flexibility in terms of time at EA Bullfrog, I guess, because, you know, Bullfrog had a lot of money behind them in terms of EA, so I didn't have to rush, so I could do things, and if they didn't work out, they could be thrown away. You know, I think I probably wrote over 12, 15 tracks for Populous, which didn't get used. But there was never any finger pointing or anything like that. Like, you know, what are you doing with your time? You were allowed to be creative and you were allowed to do things which may not work out in the end, as long as by the time the game went alpha, you had delivered what was needed, you know, which was quite a nice environment to work in.
Well, Theme Park was obviously one of Bullfrog's biggest franchises. And Theme Park World was interesting. When did you first hear about that? And what was kind of EA's reaction to Roller Coaster Tycoon that was around at that point?
The Theme Park World, for me, was a bit of a mute point, because I was the in-house composer at Bullfrog, and I, you know, arguably, but I think I successfully did Populous. And Dungeon Keeper was before Theme Park as well. So I successfully worked on both of those games. And then my manager told me that he wanted me to pitch for Theme Park World against whatever external composers they could find who were interested in working on it. And my take on that was really that if I'm the in-house composer, I should be working on it. If they don't want me to work on it, then I shouldn't be the in-house composer. So I effectively walked away from my job begrudgingly, because I love writing music. I can't say I would have done a better job than James Hannigan, however. He did a superb job, but that's not really the issue. My involvement with Theme Park was much more kind of going back to my roots of how do I get this big thing to fit into this small thing. So Theme Park World was developed on PC, utilizing the vast amount of memory, hard drive space that the PC had to dynamically replace sounds or whatever. And then the PlayStation version obviously had 512 kilobytes of 3:1 compressed sound. So, you know, 1.5 meg. which we had to fit everything in. So I was given the PlayStation version, and it was like, right, okay, do whatever you need to do to get the sound as good as you possibly can into this very small amount of space. So I went back to a sound design based role at that point, which then continued for the rest of the time that I was at EA. I say EA Bullfrog because, you know, obviously there was a bit of a intermingle between the two, shall we say.
Well, the soundtrack received a BAFTA in the end. It seemed to be really successful.
The BAFTA it won was for best sound rather than for best music. So, because I'm a BAFTA judge myself, I judged it again this year. Now you've got one specifically for music, and then you've got another one for audio achievement. So, audio achievement would have been the closest award comparable to what they offer now. So the music would have, of course, been a part of that, but it was also the sound design work that Richard Joseph and Rebecca Parnell and Adele Cutting, or Adele Kellett as she was back then, and, you know, it was all those guys. It was a team of, I guess, about 6-7 people, I suppose, worked on the audio for Theme Park as a whole.
Well, we met in Germany at an Amiga show, and you did a fantastic performance with your violin. Could you tell us more about your kind of chiptune live performing with violins? Because that's so unique. I've never seen anything like that in my life. It's amazing.
Well, it's good to be different, isn't it? I mean, for me, the love of the sidchip has never gone away. You know, I'm 45 years old now, so I've been listening on and off to the sidchip for kind of 34 years, and for me it still doesn't sound out of date. I think it's an awesome instrument. So after my separation with my wife, I'd spent the last 10 years not really writing much music in my spare time, and suddenly I had all this free time available to write stuff. And I thought, well, I wanted to do a chiptune album, so I wrote Reawakening, and fully and completely using electronics, no violin. And then I was offered a gig at Superbyte in 2013, which was an awesome 2-day chiptune festival, basically up in Manchester, and it was like, okay, so what am I going to do? How am I going to perform this? So I bought a copy of Ableton Live, and I bought an Akai controller, and I rendered all my tracks out into stems so that I could control them in real time and muck around with them, just as most DJs do. And you know, to be honest, guys, sitting in front of a computer with a control surface and nodding my head in time to the music just did nothing for me whatsoever. You know, I've been performing on a real instrument in front of people since I was 12 years old or so. It took me 2 months, I think, before I suddenly came up with the brainwave, why don't you use the violin? I mean, to most people, I think they probably would have come up with that straight away, but for me it took 2 months before it suddenly clicked. And then the TDK set has really come on from there.
Well, recently you revisited one of the old classic companies, Codemasters, for a while. Was it like the old days, or was it totally different?
Totally different. Next question.
Yeah, okay. In a good or bad way, was it?
Cody's has been, I've been there longer than I've been anywhere else. And the main reason for that was because, as well as a love for chip music and violins and computer music and Jean-Michel Jarre or whatever, I love cars, and I love cars that sound good. And for some reason, since 2000, just about every video game I've worked on has been car related. So I've got a bit of a niche for it. And I actually think I'm quite good at it. So to get to work on dirts and grids, you know, this is before F1 came and hit me over the head. I thought I'd escaped F1 when I left EA. So I was working on proper AAA quality racing games. And for somebody who loves racing games and who loves cars, who can't enjoy that, you know? And then as things go on in your career, you end up taking more of a management responsibility. And frankly, whilst I had this kind of power-grabbing thing going on at the time, that I wanted overall control of everything to do with sound at Codemasters, from that begat more management responsibilities, you know, scheduling and all the things that I'm not, you know. The only people who are good managers are people who have trained to be managers. You know, it's the most ludicrous thing in the world to take creative people, and once they've got to a certain level in their career, is make them a manager and stop them from doing the thing that they are good at. And that's kind of what happened at Cody's. And I was a terrible manager. I'm not a people person. You know, my only thing that I'm interested in is doing whatever I possibly can to make those games sound as good as they can. And that became a bit of an issue, because I ended up not really caring for people on my team, and I didn't treat them necessarily that well. And it got to a point where I thought, enough is enough. I'm not doing something that I want to do. My staff don't want me to do that. I think they would much rather me just look after one game and just get on with it. And Cody's were going through a bit of a financial issue at the time as well. And we were spending a lot of money on the Formula One soundtracks. Awesome soundtracks. Ian Livingston, you know, he's one of the best. And I just saw a little opening that I could just save the company a bit of money and go back to doing something that I enjoyed. So I suggested that I start doing the Formula One music. So that's what happened. I ended up doing the last three Formula One games. And anything else I can't talk about because of a gagging order. But suffice to say, I'm not working there anymore. And I'm very, very happy at the moment, mentally and whatever.
Well, you are working on some Project Hubbard stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, Project Hubbard is doing very well. And actually leaving Codemasters has helped, because it's given me a bit more time to do it properly. I think if I'd been working full time, I would have spent Sunday afternoons doing it and I would have rushed it. And I am so not rushing Project Hubbard, because if I look back historically as to the things that have made an impression on me, yes, the Sid Chip did, but I can't imagine the Sid Chip without Rob Hubbard. So Rob was a massive, massive deal to me when I back, you know, in those early teens. And I need to do the best job possible on Project Hubbard, if anything, just to say thank you to Rob.
Well, Mark, I think that's a lovely note to end it on. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for sharing all your stories with us. If people want to keep up to date with what you're doing, I mean, do you tweet, do you Facebook? You've got a website people can check out?
Yeah, I'm kind of moving away from Facebook. I have been for a few years now, because I think I realised a couple of years ago what a lot of people are starting to realise now as to exactly what it is. And I've not yet found a social media platform that actually works, that you can actually communicate with people who want to hear from you. Even Twitter doesn't work. The best one I've found so far is Instagram. If you post a photograph, people will like the photograph. But yeah, I mean, I am on Facebook. There's a Facebook page, which is Mark TDK Knight. I'm on Twitter with TDK_chiptune. I've got my website. Well, the TDK website is flitkillsmoss.co.uk. And from that, at the top, you can click on the SoundCloud link, and you can click on the Bandcamp link. And then I've got my professional website. Well, it's a website promoting professional services. There's no way that the website itself is professional, because I've done it myself. But Sonic Fuel is my kind of my freelance self-employment life now. So if anybody wants to, if anybody wants to pay me to write some music for them, I would probably love to.
Well, to get away from Facebook, you could always set up a bulletin board, BBS.
Has anyone got a modem now?
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure talking to you, mate. Thank you so much for coming on.
Here you go.